This meeting is being recorded.
All right, here we go. It is time once again, after a little absence, to speak to our good friend David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Of course, his website is themediabeat.us. He joins us on a Friday morning, and we take a look at some of the big media stories for the week. And we will start off on the international basis, I do believe, David, because when you have at early stages of an earthquake, almost 200,000 people identified as dead, it is sitting there as a story that is an absolutely astounding story.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I'm glad to be joining the worthy and wise Marshall Miles, as always, and as I'm reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and the whole world's eyes are indeed upon the aftermath of this week's massive quake or quakes in Turkey and Syria. Reporting on the humanitarian work of rescue, or rather by now it has to be seen as recovery work these several days after the actual event, it's all telling us of, at this stage, 20,000 plus, probably more by the time everyone's hearing this. That's the number for deaths in Turkey, and it's much harder to assess the numbers in Syria, and even harder than that to assess in the rebel-held areas of Syria to the northwest near the border with Turkey. The Syrian civil war, of course, is still a fact of life in that country. President Assad is still being sanctioned by the Western world, and exceptions have to be made to those sanctions for international aid to go into the territory his regime holds, and more challenging perhaps for getting aid to the rebel-held communities, humanitarian agencies have to use that land crossing from Turkey known as Bab al-Hawa, which has been the United Nations' only passage point throughout the past 9 years now of the country's civil war. International journalists, perhaps most of all the Global Wire services, are working really hard to bring us all this news. Coverage of Bab al-Hawa, for instance, and the massive 18-wheeler trucks that are struggling through there to the barely accessible areas of need has come especially from Agence France-Presse. All this work is, of course, is trying to convey to this journalistic work, I mean, is trying to convey to the rest of us the appalling devastation being visited on a region that is already afflicted with terrible suffering. I mean, violence, economic collapse, refugee flight, total social and community upheaval. And now this, it's as you say, it's quite appalling. It's barely conceivable to me personally, and what these populations are going through. As you know, I've worked for the UN and for international aid agencies of the non-governmental kind as well, covering many disasters and their aftermath. But I've never been in an earthquake. This humanitarian crisis and the response that's required is utterly awe-inspiring to me.
You know, it's what's interesting about the social media aspect of this is that you're getting raw emotional footage from people, even on the streets, and you see the destruction happen in front of you. You see the people trying to help people in front of you. And if it's one thing, maybe something that social media might shine on if it were used properly, it's something like this where people band together and they show you exactly what's going on in those countries and how these buildings are collapsing. And then you hear the figures, 20, 21,000 people. This is one time social media. And I think this is where social media and media should get together to get the need out, the word out, not only about the news of itself, but what goes on now in the next weeks and months afterward.
Yes, indeed. The real time. I'm sorry, I was interrupting you. the real time nature of this is quite extraordinary. You're right. I mean, we are now in a phase of our technological development where we can see this kind of thing in real time. And it's brought to us not by the professional communicators, but by the people themselves involved in it. And it does have an appalling kind of raw reality to it, which is all to the good in the sense that it engages people. And we know that it's having its impact on the humanitarian donations that are being made to all the agencies that are working hard. America is now one of the great sort of fundraising areas for support for this, and it's certainly having its effect. As I say, it's the upside of the fact that social media is a kind of democratization of our means of communication, and we know it's open to terrible abuse, and we talk about it just about every week in this slot, saying how social media can be so abused by bad actors who want to, you know, get up to evil doing. But the upside of it is this, that we do see the reality on the ground so much more quickly than we would otherwise. And of course, regular traditional media, if you like, has to follow suit. And indeed, it becomes another source, a really valuable source for us professional communicators who are trying our best not just to portray the instant horror, but the context in which it's happening and the efforts that are being made to rescue and then eventually to recover from this terrible disaster.
You know, earthquakes, typhoons, tsunamis, wars, all have multiple parts. And yes, it is a disaster when the earthquake happens. But just like in war, there's a follow-up disaster when earthquake happens. And that's what happens to the people who've been affected by it. There's, you know, it's not just the disaster itself; it's the overall disaster of the human fight for life and dignity.
And indeed, and of course, in this particular area, it comes on the heels of an appalling disaster already, humanitarian disaster of extraordinary proportions. Several million people moved around unwillingly in Syria because of that war, and now many of them in Syria, fleeing Syria and then being hit once again by the earthquake whose epicenter was in Turkey. Like every humanitarian disaster, as you say, it goes through phases. And the terrible thing about one of the bad things about media coverage, of course, is it fades away. And it's important to keep our eyes on this story, even after the immediate urgency seems to have passed. Because as you say, it'll be a disaster of a long haul nature as time goes on, inevitably.
All right, we'll move on.
I want to bring up some other journalistic work, if I may, Marshall. So some other
Absolutely.
Journalistic work in that broad region of what we often call the Greater Middle East. It needs to be noted this week, even though it's been overshadowed, I mean, understandably and inevitably, by all that important quake coverage. And it's an opportunity for our occasional fanfare, too, if we want to play that, because it goes to someone working on the network that we're ourselves part of, NPR. Our fanfare would be for Mary Louise Kelly of All Things Considered, who with her production team's been, she's managed to get into Iran, never an easy place to report on. And this week, she's been sending us dispatches just about every day about the massive crackdown there on protests that started as a reaction to the death, you'll remember, of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who died in custody, of the so-called morality police, who arrested her for allegedly wearing a hijab head covering improperly. The angry upheaval that resulted after her death has been even more widespread than the country's previous nationwide protests in 2017 and 2019 too. And Mary Louise Kelly has had a good, long-standing set of contacts established in Iran, but she hasn't actually been there. since before COVID. And the changes she's been able to report this week are quite remarkable. She's made a point of simply highlighting one very evident fact. Iranian women are now walking around with their heads uncovered. Kelly talked to regular citizens, anonymously, of course, given the situation, and heard some of the, much of the anger that has boiled up being very strongly expressed about the government's repressive policies in general, not just the dress code, of course. And Kelly also nabbed an interview with the foreign minister, Hussein Amir Abdollah Hania. He denied to her that those mass arrests, especially those of journalists, have been taking place at all. One question or interjection, I should say, that Kelly made about those arrests was telling. She said, 93 and counting, right in the minister's face. That's a lot. And he didn't agree, of course, but he tried instead to steer the interview with his own accusations about crimes committed by people he called scammers and fraudsters, and why wasn't the Western media covering all that? But Kelly wasn't having it. I'm asking the questions here, was her message. And this was straightforward, what I call bread and butter reporting. Direct, first-hand observation, well-delivered, and some firm holding of authorities' feet to the fire of determined questioning. and I would say, you know, this is why we have reporters, or one important reason anyway. So let's hear it for Mary Louise Kelly and All Things Considered.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to get on to some other news that's not quite as significant, but it's still significant. And that was the State of the Union address has become something of a spectacle for another reason that it was not intended to be a spectacle. And that's by participation of people who disagree with the president to yell and join in.
Yes, indeed.
And which was amazing how sleepy Joe Biden was prepared for this and really did a fantastic job in handling that situation and put the Republicans on the defensive while the rest of the country could see that at that particular moment, sleepy Joe Biden was in firm control.
Yeah, in a way, it's media business as usual, even though the spike of particular interest has been rather pointed. I mean, this time of year, we just expect it. It's traditional for the president to give the State of the Union speech to both houses of Congress. I mean, sometimes it can be as early as the first week of the year, and even as late as March. But this year, it was just about in the usual time, and it was predictable enough. Except perhaps for some possibly surprising raucousness that you mentioned from a lot of Republicans. But how surprising, really? I mean, we saw the beginnings of that behavior back in Barack Obama's time with the that infamous yell from a South Carolina congressman, "You lie," came the phrase. Remember that? And that particular congressman got admonished. Can you? I cherish that word. Admonished by the House of Representatives. Well, you know, since then, we've now degenerated to liar being shouted at the president, the noun itself, and of the, well, how am I going to say this? Oh, the in full version of the abbreviation BS, I guess I can say. All that being thrown at President Biden. And as you pointed out, he seemed to enjoy it very interestingly. I mean, in media terms, it's one of the delights, if you can call it that, of live television. We don't often get it. It wasn't planned for in any evident way, though, of course, the White House may well have expected it. And he certainly relished the chance for some interactive give and take that was offered to him. It was a pretty good way for him to show everyone who doesn't want him to run again that he's not senile, put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one final story that we have to hit on, simply because it involves the two biggest economies in the world, the United States and China, was the saga of the spy balloon and how it captured America, American media, for about a week and is still capturing the media.
Right. Well, it's gone through phases. It's even had a kind of comic phase in a way. Some of the Republicans were trying to poke fun at the whole thing by walking around the Congress buildings with silver balloons above them. It's hard to know what to make of it, except that China is, of course, and who would be surprised by this, playing its role as the challenger to the United States domination of the world economy and world geopolitical status. It's collecting intelligence everywhere, and more than just the Americas continent. The entire globe, they've now been seen, though only retrospectively. It's interesting that so much of their use of the balloons, which are obviously to evade detection, but at the same time are kitted out with enough technology to be able to pick up electronic information of a really quite serious kind, but it's been done. It's been found out about. It's been analyzed only retrospectively by Western intelligence agencies, the United States in particular, and at least four times they went over United States territory with these balloons without being detected. Now, of course, this one was detected. It was followed for a whole week, and then finally shot down over water safely enough. Otherwise, it might have done a lot of collateral damage to American citizens even. So that, in a way, it was well handled. It's questionable how well handled it was by the Chinese for them to attempt it at all at a time when it was just imminently on the eve of a meeting by Secretary of State Tony Blinken. A meeting that was only there, was only planned to happen because Chairman Xi of China and President Biden met later months of last year and decided to try and get things on a better footing between the two major economies. And that was supposed to have happened just at the point that this balloon was discovered. So it doesn't look like it was handled very well by the Chinese. It's conceivable at least that it was a massive error on their part. And of course now they're trying to minimize completely what was going on. But the more we examine, according to what's being put out by the intelligence agencies themselves, what they're discovering about the actual equipment, the remains of which are being fished out of the Atlantic, it suggests that it was indeed an intelligence gathering exercise, and the Chinese are still trying to maintain that all it was collecting information about weather. I think I know what I'd believe out of those two contending notions, but it's so remarkable what it may be pointing up in general is a terrible intelligence failure on our Western nation's part that it wasn't understood as what it, the real truth of what these balloons were doing, or even their very existence, wasn't really known until after the event.
Well, once again, a pretty interesting week, and the way media has covered it, from the highs of some of the coverage of the journalism on the earthquake and some of the local coverage of that. And as you said, the reports from the NPR reporter out of Iran. So we've had a great look at the media this week, David. And once again, son of a gun, I think we'll do it again next week. What do you think?
We will do it next week. Absolutely.
All right, David, have a great weekend, and we'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to it. Bye now.